Case number 07-1451 et al. Goya Foods Incorporated, doing business as Goya Foods of Florida, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Miller for the petitioner, Ms. Fillo for the respondent.
Just waiting to clear here. Yes, counsel for petitioner.
May it please the court and counsel, David Miller for petitioner employer Goya. I would reserve 6 minutes. This case is the third in a series. Fairly simple, the simplest of the three to begin with, and I believe that the passage of time has rendered it even simpler. My intent is to focus on two issues, essentially. The RoadNet trip planning software, the effects bargaining that was ordered on that, and the back pay that was ordered on that, and then second, the refusals procedure. Now, as to the RoadNet trip planning software, I believe that the passage of time, the decisions, the past decisions of the court have rendered remedies in these cases, and I'm not conceding the merits on these, but remedies have been rendered virtually obsolete, and I believe the entry of an order by this court as the board has ordered it would essentially be a useless act from which the court could well abstain. Now, why is that? RoadNet, trip planning software, determines where the drivers will go the next day. We've been ordered to effects bargaining because RoadNet supposedly affects how those trips are planned, where they go, to whom they deliver. Well, previously in Goya 1 and 2,
That's not a complete explanation of it, is it? Isn't the argument that the RoadNet software actually ended up with trips that were longer or had more to do for the driver and affected their wages? That's a little bit different than the way you described it.
Well, I was speaking functionally of what the software itself does. Legally, the board has
found... The issue isn't over the implementation of the software. It's over the effects of the software.
That is correct. The decision to implement was fine. However, the effects of the remedy, the ordered bargaining and the back pay, essentially are going to be duplicative of the prior ordered remedy in Goya 1, in which it was found that driver delivery assignments were first fixed and then varied, the variation being found to be a violation. We've been ordered into bargaining on that. We've been ordered to back pay on that. That was prior in time to RoadNet. We are currently in bargaining and currently in compliance, voluntary compliance with the board on that. Essentially, any bargaining, any back pay flowing out of RoadNet, the whole question of whether it's appropriate or not aside, is going to be duplicative. It's going to be subsumed in the ongoing bargaining that's going on right now, and it's certainly going to be subsumed in any calculation.
If you are bargaining, then there's not going to be any question with respect to whether any money is available. That will be resolved in compliance procedures.
And that takes us to the sort of the meritorious or the substantive argument on RoadNet. If you look at the evidence that's in the record, you'll see that there was essentially a some variation, not very much, if you look at the ALJ's.
No, but my point is that's not something we consider. The board has not addressed this in compliance yet. So when they say back pay, we understand the board always means as may be appropriate. We don't try and anticipate what the compliance procedures might produce.
That is correct. But in this case, the administrative law judge found ab initio that essentially there could be no back pay, that it was inappropriate in this case, and effectively
we're reviewing the board, not the ALJ.
That's correct, and we're contesting that the board overturned the ALJ's finding and conclusion on back pay.
If the board was right that there was a violation and that one of the remedies might be back pay, the question as to whether any money actually gets passed pursuant to that remedy goes in compliance, not now.
Not necessarily. In the posture, rather unusual posture of this case, the ALJ made a finding that in this case, under these circumstances, back pay would not be appropriate. I think effectively what he found was that it could not be proven, and therefore
that's compliance.
Did not.
That's
in this case, the ALJ anticipated
compliance.
That.
That's in compliance. We're reviewing the board, not the ALJ. That's the ALJ's surmise, and it's there. And when the board goes to compliance, that can be raised to the extent that it's appropriate. But we don't know what the board might. It may be that that will be the end result, and no money will be passed.
Well, it may well be, and that might be ordinarily a subject for compliance proceedings. But in this case, the ALJ has essentially ruled in advance that back pay would not be appropriate. The board reversed that.
Right. That's who we're reviewing. It doesn't matter what the ALJ. The ALJ's decision has now been taken over by the board.
That is correct. And we are, to the extent that I keep saying ALJ,
right,
that's because that's where the point that I am pressing came from. The board is incorrect in saying that in this particular case, back pay calculations in compliance or anywhere else are appropriate flowing out of RoadNet. Because effectively what happened in this case, as recognized in the original decision but reversed by the board, was that I think in essence the employer's affirmative defense that there were no losses suffered by anyone affected by this was already made. Therefore, what's the point of ordering a back pay remedy when it has already been proven that there were no losses? I think effectively that's what the decision was that the board reversed. It is our position that this court should say that the board was wrong, that effectively affirmative defense was proven at the trial stage, and the board should rest with that. Now, back to the second point, which was the refusals procedure. This effectively is very much an elevation of form over function or style over substance. What we have, the board finds that the signing requirement is what elevated this change to a substantial and material change in terms and conditions of employment. The board concedes, as did the board's witnesses at the trial, that the responsibility of the drivers for the merchandise that they were carrying was the same before and after the new procedure was instituted. And all that changed was effectively the driver signing his name under a statement that had been on this paper all along.
It was a different statement, though, right? I mean, the second statement was far more detailed than the first.
No, no, Your Honor. The statement never changed. The statement was pre-printed on these forms, and it did not change at all. Now, the board tries to bolster this argument by saying that driver Chavez was discharged because he refused to sign. That certainly was a part, but only a part. And if we look at the reply brief on page 6 of the reply brief, we see that the testimony of the president of the company is far from what was cited in the board's brief. The board would have Mr. Yinonwe saying, well, he was fired because he did not sign. That's not correct. What Mr. Yinonwe did was cite a number of bases for Driver Chavez being terminated. The fundamental basis was that he was insubordinate. However, he also impeded another employee's work and essentially refused to comply with the pre-existing responsibility that he already had.
Can I interrupt you for a second? I'm sorry. I'm looking at page 73 of the Joint Appendix tab 9 as a follow-up to my last question. And it was Mr. I guess this is it pronounced Mr. Yinonwe? Is that his?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
As I read it, he said, the judge says, was there some kind of memorandum? Why don't you tell us what took place? We're talking about refusals, and the witness said, at that time, the refused merchandise was verified, counted, and was noted on the summary or front trip and acknowledged and signed by the drivers. It wasn't just boilerplate language.
I'm sorry,
It wasn't just boilerplate language. After April 2nd, there was a different type of form that was signed where they had to verify precisely what was in the truck, whereas before that, it was a boilerplate statement of responsibility. They're very different documents.
And Your Honor, before I respond, I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I would ask to respond to the court's question and then retire. In point of fact, what happened was there was a trip front or a trip sheet which summarized where the drivers would go every day. And it would say you're going to Winn-Dixie, you're going to Publix, you're going to this place, the other place, and so on. Behind those would be invoices or statements which particularized each delivery. On the trip front was printed the language that I referred to that says, I acknowledge that I'm responsible for the contents of the truck. Essentially, that's what it said. After the new refusals procedure was put into place, the driver would return from his day's deliveries, and he would stop at the credit tent, just as he always had. The person who was stationed at the credit tent, credit refusals tent, would climb into the truck, look at the refusals, write them down, and the two cans of this, half a case of that, whatever, present the trip front to the truck driver, who would then sign. That was the only change. The language stayed the same. To the extent that someone wrote down two cans of beans, there was a difference.
All right. We'll hear counsel for response. No? Good morning.
I'm Mackenzie Fellow and I represent the NLRB, and I'm here to ask you to enforce the board's order in this case because it's supported by substantial evidence. I agree with co-counsel that this is a very simple case. The company has spent the last 10 years fighting the decision of its employees to unionize, and this has led the board to decide four cases against them. This case involves changes that the company made to its employees' terms and conditions of employment after the vote for unionization. As co-counsel noted, they instituted this new inspection procedure, and the procedure became a condition of continued employment, as Chavez's termination shows. They didn't just have to sign acknowledging some rule that had always been in place. It was a completely new rule. The new rule wasn't just they can't steal. It was that they have to go onto the truck at the end of their shift, look through all the merchandise that's on there, make sure it's on the form, and sign to verify that the form accurately reflects what's in the truck. They didn't have to do that before. This is a change, and it materially affected employees' jobs, and it became a condition of continued employment. Even if Chavez was terminated for other reasons, which he wasn't, the company president also testified that if any employee refused to follow the procedure, they would be subjected to discipline. New rules that may subject employees to discipline violate the act. It had an impact on these employees.
No, you didn't state that correctly.
I'm sorry? New rules that may subject employees to discipline.
Violate the act.
If they do it without bargaining.
That's different.
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. Another, The other changes that they made were assigning stores to delivery drivers and assigning routes to employees after they began using RoadNet. And these clearly impacted the employees. I mean, it increased their hours and it increased their pay. Those are the basic mandatory subjects of bargaining, and the company made these changes without bargaining.
What's your response on their no back pay due question?
Well, as you noted, that's for compliance. The board regularly...
There was one, I think, even using the ALJ, there's at least one driver.
Yes, I think Pedro Varela, maybe, is his name. He experienced a pay loss. But even the ones who made more money, they worked a lot more hours.
You know,
their hourly rate...
I understand your argument on that. I was just...
So that will all be, they will are free to argue that in compliance, and they may be correct that no one is owed back pay, but that's not what we're here to talk about today.
I just want to clarify, after, given the decision by the 11th Circuit, counsel is, as I understood it, in part is arguing that subsumes some of the issues in this case. Is that correct?
Well, in that case, they did change people's routes, and they were ordered to stop doing it, but they kept doing it to different employees, and those different employees have different remedies coming to them based on the damages that they may have suffered. So they are committing similar violations, but they are distinct charges based on distinct decisions made by the company at different times. After
my notes to myself said that the charges in this case address changes made by the employer before the 11th Circuit issued its decision.
That's right.
And so my question is, there's no overlap in terms of employees or incidents or?
In 1998 and 1999, those were the violations that Goya 1 dealt with and the 11th Circuit enforced.
Right.
The company, without bargaining, redistributed the routes of employees who were terminated or on leave, and these employees were Domingo Villar, Carlos Gonzalez, Mario Robinson, Rolando Aguiar.
So they're different employees?
Yes. This case involves the redistribution of Chavez's route.
Okay, that's
several years later.
All right.
In 2001.
All right. So there's not complete overlap.
Right.
All right.
Are there any other questions? If not, then I would just like to say that our decision is supported by substantial evidence, and we ask you to enforce it in full. Thank you.
All right, counsel for petitioner.
Your Honor, let me quickly address the bargaining as to driver Chavez's routes. The order states that will be left to bargaining. There's no remedy ordered as to Chavez's, the redistribution of his delivery assignments after he was terminated. The 11th Circuit order contemplates, and the affirmative bargaining order in that case, contemplates that Goya will look back to the state of delivery assignments as they stood in 1998 and will bargain based on that basis, that period in time. The assignment changes flowing from RoadNet, the effects of RoadNet, if any, occurred 2 years later, I believe, or 3 years later in 2001 or 2002. To that extent, it's going to be one and the same.
But they're not duplicative.
Well, they are duplicative, and it's not in evidence.
All I meant was duplicative in the sense it's different times.
Different times, but essentially the same flowing river of assignments, day by day, and we're to bargain over those, and we are bargaining over those. And finally, as to the refusals process, again, the board has argued that what made it material, what made it a violation, was the signing requirement. That is what the board says and relies upon in its order, not the de minimis as found by the ALJ, time that it took for the refusals to be inspected, not the delineation of what was being refused. It was the signing requirement. The signing requirement was nothing more than an acknowledgement of a pre-existing obligation, nothing more than the acknowledgement that, yes, I know that yesterday I could have been disciplined for not observing work rules, and today
you,
I could
you
be
could
disciplined.
Be discharged for failure to sign it, right? I mean, there, it became a term of employment. If you didn't sign it, you would be discharged.
It always was. It always was. The signing itself was not the term of employment. What he was terminated for, what he was discharged for, was what he could have been discharged for the day before, and that is impeding other employees, insubordination, in defying a...
I thought the testimony was that that but for his refusal to sign, he wouldn't have been fired. Am I
that,
wrong?
That is, in my view, the mischaracterization in the board's brief, and I do cite the transcript where that is put forth. And so in closing, Your Honor, we would say that this would be essentially a useless order. The court should abstain, all arguments on the merits aside. Of course, we stand by those arguments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.